Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 189, Lucid Dreaming with Robert Wagoner. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
My view is much like I believe the Buddhist view is that becoming more consciously aware is for the better. And even becoming more consciously aware in the dreaming is for the better, because the greater awareness you bring to situations, the greater growth you have, the more quickly you have growth, and the deeper the understanding can be.
That was the voice of my guest, Robert Wagoner. He's the author of the 2008 book, Lucid Dreaming, Gateway to the Inner Self, and the co-editor of the quarterly publication, The Lucid Dream Exchange. Lucid dreaming refers to the ability to become consciously aware in the dream state while dreaming. Those who have experienced this unique state are likely to agree with the first scientist to prove lucid dreaming, Dr. Keith Hearn, who said, philosophically, scientifically, it is simply mind-blowing. Over the past 30 years, Robert has logged more than 1,000 lucid dreams and deeply explored the dream state's potential for information, healing, and creativity while consciously aware. In the book, Robert explains how to become consciously aware in dreams, maintain your awareness, and actively engage the dream environment, plus the apparent awareness behind the dream. A summa cum laude graduate of Drake University with a degree in psychology, Robert also is president-elect of the International Association for the Study of Dreams. Now, here's the interview. Robert Wagoner, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, David. I'm glad to be here.
I'm not sure if you remember my conducting a brief interview with you a couple of years ago at the International Association for the Study of Dreams conference that was at Sonoma State University, but I'm happy to have the opportunity to view you at greater length now.
Well, great. Yeah, and I appreciate being back.
Yeah, I sat in on a couple of the presentations that you did there, and they were very interesting. And since that time, you've become president of IASD, and you've got a 2009 book on lucid dreaming that's just now coming out, which makes you doubly interview worthy.
well, thanks. And I should mention that I'm president-elect of IASD. Assuming everything goes as I hope, I'll be president beginning July of 2009.
Okay, well, that's pretty exciting. I think we can pretty much assume that my listeners will know that the term lucid dream refers to a dream in which you become aware that you're dreaming and at least some of the time can make some conscious choices inside the dream. Do I have that right, or do you want to polish that apple a bit?
That's the basic idea. Lucid dream is when you become consciously aware when you're dreaming that you're dreaming. And once you become consciously aware that you're dreaming, then you can think about the choices that you could make in the dream, direct the dream in a way that you'd like it to go, and actually experiment and do a lot of interesting things.
Okay, well, before we go deeper into the topic and your book, let me ask you how you first got into the study of dreams and then into lucid dreaming specifically.
Boy, you know, probably the first book on dreams I read was one by Fritz Perls, the Gestalt therapist.
Sure.
This was back in the early 70s, I think. One of my brothers had come home from college. I was still in high school, I think, and had a book about Gestalt Gestalt therapy. That was my first introduction to dreams. Probably, though, the way that I got into lucid dreaming was by reading the third book by Carlos Castaneda called Journey to Ixlan.
Oh, yes, I remember those Carlos Castaneda books very well.
Right, and in the third book, his teacher, Don Juan, gave him a technique for becoming consciously aware in the dream state. And I was just a junior in high school, but I was interested in that sort of thing. And so within a few days practice, I had my first consciously aware dream that I had incubated.
Well, his instruction, as I recall, was to remember to look at your hands in the dream. Is that how you did it?
Right. You know, I was a little bit uncertain when I was reading the book exactly what the technique was. And so what I did was this. Before I'd go to sleep, I'd look at the palm of my hands, and because I knew about the power of suggestion, I'd tell myself as I looked at my hands, tonight in my dreams, I'll see my hands and realize I'm dreaming. And so I'd do that for about 4 or 5 minutes until I got sleepy, and then I'd turn off the light and go to sleep. And about 3 or 4 nights after doing this consistently, I was having a dream that I was walking through the hallway of my high school when all of a sudden my hands popped right up in front of my face. And just at that moment, I realized, oh, my God, it's my hands. This is a dream. And I was just stunned to be aware in the dreaming.
Did that pull you out? I know the few times I've had lucid dreams, I got so excited by the fact that, oh, my goodness, I'm in a dream, that it woke me up. Did that happen to you?
You know, that was something that I learned later on, is that you really have to modulate your emotions when you become consciously aware in a dream state. Just like you discovered, David, people who get too excited normally just wake themselves up because they get so excited. And so in that first lucid dream of mine, I think at first I was just too amazed by it all, that the idea that everything around me was a dream, that all these people that looked like my high school schoolmates were just actually dream figures. It was just a mind-blowing observation. And so actually my first lucid dream there lasted quite a while, because I remembered another instruction of Don Juan that was when the dream started to get shaky or started to seem like it was going to fall apart, to look back at your hands and stabilize the dream. And so I got to a part of the lucid dream where it started to get shaky, and I looked back at my hands, and that stabilized the lucid dream. So actually my first consciously sought lucid dream actually lasted a relatively long time.
Wow. You know, I'm wondering if the fact that you were in high school and you were young, so you were getting started at this at a younger age than when I first made my attempts, when I first heard about it. And I'm just wondering if maybe starting early, you know, before a lot of adult ideas about the nature of reality have rigidified, do you know of any evidence or research that might support my hypothesis that maybe starting young would be helpful?
You know, I share your feeling. I do think it helps to start young, and I do think it helps to start young because at that age, you're still searching and seeking and curious, and you conceptually are pretty wide open. You don't have a bunch of strong theories that you believe in or have a rigid belief system. And so I haven't seen any studies about that, particularly about the age of first lucid dreaming or anything. But I do think you're onto something there, because just like learning how to play golf when you're a little kid or learning how to ice skate when you're a little kid, just somehow your physical muscles kind of learn those motions. I think by lucid dreaming at an early age, when I was like 15 or 16, kind of got my mental muscles acclimated to what it takes to be consciously aware in the dream state.
Yes, I like that phrase, mental muscles. I think there is something to mental muscles, and I sometimes despair at how flabby my mental muscles seem to be becoming. Have you? Go ahead.
You know what? One thing I did want to say, David. The other thing, as a junior, as a high school kid, I was very disciplined when it came to these kind of things. Like I learned about self-hypnosis, and it was something that I practiced every day.
Wow.
And so I realized that this kind of activity, whether it's hypnosis or self-hypnosis or lucid dreaming or whatever it is, it's one of those things you have to persist at it a bit. And oftentimes when people tell me they're having a difficult time becoming consciously aware in the dream state, I talk to them a little bit about the importance of persisting and consistently practicing.
And you were a kid growing up in the Midwest, as I recall. Were you like growing up? I seem to have the impression from our previous interview that you grew up in a rural area. I mean, it's not like you grew up in California, which is a hotbed of these kinds of pursuits.
Yeah, you know, that's right. I grew up in Hutchinson, Kansas, a town about 40 or 50,000 people out in the flat wheat prairie of Kansas, and really kind of a beautiful place to grow up, because the nice thing about doing lucid dreaming back then in 1975, I encouraged some of my my high school friends to do this, and some of them succeeded at becoming consciously aware in the dream state, but they didn't get enamored with it like I did. But in some ways, it's kind of nice to have done this where it wasn't a big deal, because it allowed me just to pursue it out of deep curiosity and deep wonderment about how a person could be consciously aware in the dream state.
And I also seem to recall, sort of hearkening back to that earlier brief interview, that while a lot of the people who present at these conferences and so on are psychotherapists or psychologists, you're in some other completely different line of work, aren't you?
You know, I graduated with a degree in psychology, and I planned to go on to be a psychotherapist, but at the time, the family business that my parents had started was kind of struggling, and so I thought, oh, I'll go help them for a few years, and then I'll go on and get a doctorate and become a psychotherapist. But I got involved in the family business, and I've been involved with it for the last 26 years, and it's just only here in the past year, after writing my book, that I decided to step away from that. So I kept my interest in dreaming and lucid dreaming, and really a deep curiosity in it all those years, even though I was also very much involved in business.
Yes. Have your lucid dreams changed or evolved over time?
You know, they honestly have. That's one thing that I try to get across in the book, that lucid dreaming has incredible depth to it if you continue to practice at it, continue to try to expand it, to conceptually develop new areas in your lucid dreaming. It can keep growing and growing. And so in the initial years of lucid dreaming, it was actually before people even knew what lucid dreaming was. And in fact, it wasn't until, I think, 1980 when Stephen LaBerge published his scientific proof of lucid dreaming was the first time that people would accept it. Before then, when I'd tell my high school teachers or college professors about it, they told me it was impossible to become consciously aware in the dream state, that it was a contradiction. And I told them, no, I was becoming aware. I could do, you know, pretty much whatever I wanted to do. And they assured me that it wasn't. But in those early years, basically, it was easy just to play around and learn about the principles of the dream environment and the principles of how to conduct yourself in the dream. It took me quite a while to really see this as a platform for experimenting in the dream state, and also a platform for exploring the depths of the psyche and what I would call identity as well.
Yes, I like that concept of it being a platform for research, for inner research. In the book, you actually talk about five stages of lucid dreaming on pages 101 through 104. I don't know if you've got a copy of the book.
Yeah, I sure do. Thank you. You know what? The first stage is one that really involves what I call personal play, pleasure, and pain avoidance. And in that stage, and the lucid dreamer is just so amazed at being consciously aware in the dream state that they kind of treat it as a joyful area to just play around in. They make things happen. They seek out pleasure. If a dream figure bothers them or something, they just obliterate it or run away. So that's the first stage of lucid dreaming. And unfortunately, for a lot of people, that's the only stage that they really ever get into. They never try to move much beyond that because it's so fun. There's nothing more fun than being consciously aware in the dream state and just doing whatever you want to do. And you can fly, you can go through walls, you can make things appear and disappear. And it's just so much fun that people just stay at that stage.
Yeah, it's interesting. It probably corresponds to almost a kind of moral stage of development or a spiritual stage of development that many of us get stuck at the level of sensory pleasure, let's say, kind of corresponds to that.
Yeah, you know, when I was writing that chapter, it kind of reminded me of Jean Piaget, and cognitive development, kind of the stages of cognitive development, because oftentimes the lucid dreamer is pretty much at the beginning, just like a child who's 1 year old. The lucid dreamer is very amazed by sensation. Mm-hmm. A lot of lucid dreamers at the beginning, they just walk around touching things just to get that sensation, comparing how it feels in the dream reality versus the corresponding feel of like a leaf or a brick wall or something in physical reality. And so I remember a lot of my first lucid dreams was just walking around touching things, you know, just seeing how it compared.
Yes. And all.
But that's the first stage, and that's where a lot of people spend much of their time.
Okay, so if the first stage is kind of about frolic, what's the second stage?
The second stage I call manipulation, movement, and me. Well, once you become consciously aware, it finally occurs to you that you can manipulate many of the dream objects. You can, in some sense, manipulate the dream figures. And also an important thing is to move, because you have that visual sense in dreaming, and oftentimes you want to fly up to that hill and investigate the castle up there, or fly over to where you see some other dream figures. And so that's kind of when you first start to want to learn the mechanics of, okay, how does this really work? How can I function at my best in this environment? And it's all about me moving and manipulating the environment. And so that's what I consider the second stage.
Okay, and then moving along to stage three.
It's when you become, to some degree, kind of an ego-inflated lucid dreamer. And by that I mean you have started to understand it so well that you have an incredible sense of power, purpose, and primacy. And by primacy, you get the sense that you are the only important thing in that dream environment. And unfortunately, that's a very limiting sort of viewpoint to take. But oftentimes you'll find the lucid dreamers, they're manipulating everything, they're moving around, they're doing everything they want, and they're doing it with a great sense of power. But that was one thing that Castaneda was told by Don Juan was actually something to watch out for. He said that the world was much too mysterious, and I'd say dreaming is also much too mysterious and awesome that to really be controlled by the lucid dreamer. And so that leads to this fourth stage, which I call re-reflection, reaching out, and wonder. And that's when you start to realize as a lucid dreamer that actually you don't control everything, that there's dream figures who do what they want to do, sometimes in direct opposition to what you want them to do. Also, you realize that there's unexpected elements in the lucid dream state that you could never imagine having occurred. And then you begin to wonder, boy, maybe I do not control this at all. Maybe there's something else going on here. And that's what I've always asked people to consider. So often people think that lucid dreaming is about controlling the dream, and I told them that that's a mistake. Lucid dreaming is really about directing one's focus within the dream. I bring up the idea that the sailor does not control the sea, and neither does the lucid dreamer control the dream. The lucid dreamer does his or her best to direct their focus, but they definitely don't control the dream.
I like that metaphor. And so what's the final fifth stage that you've identified?
You know, the final fifth stage is something that was very strange that began to happen to me after about 20 years of lucid dreaming. I had gone about as deep as I could go, and then I began to think that there's more than likely something beyond lucid dreaming, that there's something beyond all of this symbolism, beyond these dream figures, that they come from some source. And even though they were tied to my beliefs and expectation and my intent and will, that they were obviously from beyond the ego me. And so I was trying to become lucid about lucid dreaming. And that was the stage when I started to have some very unusual experiences. Basically what happened, I started having experiences of light. I'd wake up in the morning and I'd sit down to put something in my dream journal, but all I could remember the entire night was light. And there wasn't any objects, there wasn't any me, there wasn't any other dream figures.
Wow.
It was just light. And so at that point, I honestly didn't know what was going on. I had some other experiences of light during that time period, and kind of realized that I had finally gone beyond lucid dreaming and came to a point of light. It wasn't until about 3 years later, I was at an Association for the Study of Dreams conference in the North Shore of Oahu, Hawaii, and they had a Buddhist Lama come speak. His name was Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche, and he spoke about the Buddhist Bon tradition of dream yoga and how the ultimate goal of dream yoga, well, what was basically what they called the clear light experience. And it was the first time I'd ever heard anyone talk about using lucid dreaming as a path to deep experiences, deep spiritual experiences, and the clear light experience, which they consider a non-dual state. So there's not a subject-object. It's basically a unified state of consciousness, is one way, I guess, of saying it. So it's very interesting to see that someone like myself, who grew up out here in the Midwest, who grew up in a traditional Protestant family, by going deeper and deeper and deeper, 20 years into lucid dreaming at that time, started to have experiences that Buddhists have been talking about apparently for the last few thousand years, even though that was definitely outside of the realm of my experience.
Yes, that is really fascinating and really kind of a validation of the experiences that they were describing, showing that it really is about a kind of a mental training and mental discipline, and that if one follows the steps, that anybody can have that sort of experience. Theoretically, anybody can. I don't know. I want to come back to that point in just a moment, but before I do, you're sort of talking about the white light experience in the past. Is this something that discontinued after a while or retreated, or is it still going on for you?
Well, I think if you talk with any experienced lucid dreamers, one thing you'll find them often talking about is a quality of light. Sometimes in lucid dreams, you'll have very interesting experiences with light, you know, light being an object or light shooting out of a building or light shooting out of the eyes of a dream figure or something like that. But this was definitely different because there really wasn't any objects or figures or anything like that. There wasn't even a sense of myself in these experiences of light. So they primarily occurred at that period when I realized that the only way to resolve the issues that I was having at the time was to go beyond lucid dreaming. And you get, by dealing with lucid dreaming, of course, you kind of come to understanding a separate reality or an alternate reality, because once you become consciously aware in the dream state, relatively consistently, you begin to realize it has principles. It seems to be full of information. It's much like the physical reality we live in and are a part of, but it's an alternate reality with its own rules and functioning. But at the same time, when you kind of start to view this reality as something of a mental construct, and you realize lucid dreaming as a mental construct, then you get to the point where you're deeply, deeply invested in getting beyond mental constructs, getting beyond symbolism, getting beyond that. And that's where my head was when that occurred. And basically, my deepest experiences of these clear light experiences occurred over the course of about a year's time.
Well, this is all really fascinating. Now, I have the impression that lucidity comes a lot easier to some than others, and it sounds like you were on the end of the continuum where it came pretty easily. And I guess, you know, in some ways it can be seen as a basic human skill or propensity, like athletic ability or musical ability, that we all start at a different place, and there's some room for improvement for each of us. I know I've had, I think I'm somewhere near the other end. I don't seem to get there for trying. I've had a few instances of rather brief lucidity, and I've pretty much trained myself to realize that falling dreams and nightmares are dreams sufficiently to pull myself up out of them, but not to do something more creative, like turn the fall into flying or something like that.
You know, in my book, I mention a story of talking to one of my nieces who is in college, and I was asking her about her dream life and then asked her about her lucid dream life, and she told me she'd had 10 or 15 lucid dreams, but then she added that they didn't mean anything. And I said, well, wait a second. Well, what do you mean they don't mean anything? And she goes, I become consciously aware in the dream state, and, you know, if I'm in a bad part of town, I'll fix up the buildings, or I'll bring some trees into a treeless area or something. And that's what she did in her lucid dreams. And so I told her, I go, look, the next time you become consciously aware in the dream state, just yell out to the dream, hey, dream, show me something I should see. And so about a few months later, she called me up and she goes that she had a lucid dream, that in the dream she's being chased by a lion, and all of a sudden she realized that lions didn't exist in Kansas City, or at least they weren't running free in the streets, and she became consciously aware. And so she yelled out to the dream, hey, dream, show me something I should see. And then all of a sudden she saw this long hallway of blue light, and at the end of it was a woman with gray hair. And so she thought, well, this is interesting. So she went down there to investigate, and as soon as she got down there, she realized it was her great-grandmother. And her great-grandmother was so happy to see her, and they began to talk. And the interesting thing was her great-grandmother passed on to her information that she wasn't aware of in her waking life. And so she woke up from the lucid dream. She gave me a call, and she said, well, what do I do with this information? Because it had to do with some of the family members. And I said, call up the family members and ask them if there's any validity to this. Just tell them you had a dream with your great-grandmother. And so she did. And her family members were just blown away because she had picked up, it wasn't really a family secret or anything, but she had picked up something that the great-grandmother was very, very interested in and wanted to pass on to the rest of the family. And I think for my little niece, that validated to her that there might be something more going on here, that you might be getting into deeper levels of your conscious awareness than you normally might assume.
Yeah, a bit further on in our discussion, I'll want to kind of come back to the sort of telepathic or ESP possibilities in lucid dreaming. But before we go there, pretty much already spoken to this, but do you see lucid dreaming as a worthwhile goal? In other words, why should a person go to the trouble of trying to do it if it doesn't happen spontaneously?
Well, I think for most anyone, it would be an interesting thing to see. Just to see yourself or to find yourself consciously aware in the dream state, to realize that everything that a moment ago you took as very real and very solid and important, having that sudden switch where you realize, no, all of this is just the workings of the dream. This is just the workings of imagination. I think for everyone, that's an important point to get across. So just to have a few experiences gives everyone a taste of it, and that in and of itself is important. But for other people, if it comes naturally to you, if the dreaming path is something that you naturally feel drawn to, it can be a great supplement to your normal dreaming and also help you definitely as you investigate, you know, the boundaries of the self and the boundaries of awareness.
Yes. Now, I think you've already indicated that total control doesn't seem to be possible, that it's not total control, that the unconscious has a way of taking over, if you will. But there are some people who argue, I think, that attempting to control your dreams is a bad thing, moving you away from the spontaneous expression of the unconscious. Just another example of the ego attempting to control everything. What's your comment on that?
You know, I understand their point, and I devote most of a chapter to dealing with some of these issues. But really, my view is much like I believe the Buddhist view is that becoming more consciously aware is for the better. And even becoming more consciously aware in the dreaming is for the better, because the greater awareness you bring to situations, the greater growth you have, the more quickly you have growth, and the deeper the understanding can be. So even though we can say that all dreams are sacred, just like I often say that all dreams are sacred, it still doesn't mean that the dream wants us to arrive there without conscious awareness. It would seem like to me that if the dream was sacred, the dream would want me to be more aware in that sacred space instead of less aware. So that's how I feel about it, that the sailor doesn't control the sea, the lucid dreamer doesn't control the dream, and ultimately the lucid dreamer, if they think about it, will have greater respect and greater admiration for the power and mystery of dreaming and the unconscious self.
Well, that begs the question, what do you mean by all dreams are sacred?
Well, that in my opinion, that all dreams, by deriving from the unconscious, are leading us to a sense of greater health and greater wholeness, if we could understand it. That they're not random, they're not chaotic, that in some hard-to-understand way, that they're actually leading us towards a greater sense of being. And in that way, they're sacred.
Great. What about false awakenings? I know sometimes I've had that experience of a false awakening where I think that I've woken from the dream, but in fact, I'm still in the dream. Where do they fit into the picture?
You know, they're a curious phenomenon. I probably discovered 3 or 4 years after my first lucid dreams, I'd have lucid dreams where the dream was getting shaky, so I knew it was going to come to an end soon. And then all of a sudden, I'd be in my bedroom, I'd lean over on my nightstand to start jotting down the lucid dream, and then I'd look at my dream journal and see that I'd already written down the lucid dream. And it would occur to me, when did I write down this lucid dream? I just woke up. And that's when I'd realize, oh, I'm having a false awakening, and then I'd wake up for real. I think that Stephen LaBerge had the best view on this. He said that in his idea, false awakenings occurred because we expected to wake up, and by expecting to wake up, we kind of pushed the lucid dreaming forward. We kind of dreamed an awakening, because oftentimes in lucid dreams, our expectations are made manifest, and by expecting to wake up, we kind of created these false awakenings.
I've had a similar sort of experience where I realize that I'm in the dream, and there's sort of this feeling of, oh boy, I'm in a lucid dream. I have to go tell my friend that I had a lucid dream, you know. So
right.
I go and tell the friend, and I think that I'm telling the friend in reality, and I'm sort of missing the contradiction that I'm still in a dream.
You know, it's an interesting point, and it's one that other people have brought up as well, that even though you may be lucid or technically aware, you at the same time definitely aren't a genius or maybe not thinking the thing through exactly as we do upon waking. What it made me realize, of course, is that our beliefs and expectations are kind of the primary focus in that lucid dream. As long as we believe that our friend wants to know and we could tell our friend, you know, then we have that kind of logic that's an important thing to do. But you're right. Oftentimes you'll find yourself upon awakening thinking, why did I bother to do that? You know, I should have realized, you know, with greater clarity that this was a dream and it didn't make any sense to do what I was doing.
Yes. Now, the subtitle of your book is Gateway to the Inner Self. And I think you've already said things that sort of get at this, but I'll still ask you, can you say something about that gateway to the inner self? What do you mean?
Right. You know, one of the things that myself and other lucid dreamers have discovered is that one of the things that's most difficult to manipulate is dream figures. Or most people call them dream characters. I think that's a little bit too derogatory. I like to call them dream figures, because when you call them a character, it's like they're an imagining or a work of fiction or something like that. I call them dream figures because they seem to have, and others have discovered this, that many of the dream figures seem to have their own sense of awareness. Sometimes they're logical. Sometimes they're very reasonable. Sometimes they seem actually more aware than the lucid dreamer. And this was something that Paul Foley, who is a German psychotherapist and someone who investigated lucid dreaming deeply, discovered as well. I remember in my book, I pulled out a section of his book that's written in German, and he was having lucid dreamers try to determine how consciously aware the dream figures were. And so one of his friends became consciously aware and went up to a dream figure and asked the dream figure how consciously aware it was. And the dream figure said that I am aware, I am certain, but whether or not you are aware, I'm unsure because you asked such a silly question. And so you have these dream figures do incredible things like that, or someone will become consciously aware and tell a dream figure, I'm dreaming you. And then the dream figure responds, how do you know I'm not dreaming you? And sometimes the lucid dreamer will say, well, look, I can fly. And then the dream figure will reply, well, look, I can fly too. And then the dream figure does everything that the lucid dreamer does to try to prove their independent existence. And so when you start to have these experiences, you start to think, what's going on here? You know, these dream figures that I assumed were projections of my mind, and I assumed were just kind of these mental playthings, that they actually seem to have an awareness and cognition. And so that was the first thing that struck me, was dream figures. There seem to be different types of dream figures. So some of them are just kind of mental playthings or mental mayflies. They just express a thought or a belief, or for some reason they're in the dream. But other of these dream figures are very conscious and very alive. And that's when I started to realize, And what happened was I had a dream, where a lucid dream, where I was supposed to find what a dream figure represented. And I asked the nearby dream figure what it represented, and all of a sudden a voice boomed out of the sky above it. And that's when I realized that there might be something behind these dream figures, that there might be an awareness behind the dream figures. And that's when I started to realize that there is a deeper awareness within the dreaming. I remember Ernest Hilgard, who was a president of the APA for a while, and I believe a professor at Stanford.
Yes.
He brought up the idea of the hidden observer that you could find in deep hypnosis, that there'd be a part of the hypnotized subject, which he called the hidden observer, that was very much aware of what was going on and which the hypnotist could communicate with. And he was always struck by the intelligence and the businesslike aspect of the hidden observer and that sort of thing. And also sometimes psychologists dealing with people with dissociative identity disorder or multiple personality disorder would sometimes find too what they call a center or an internal self-helper, kind of a portion of the psyche that was aware of what all the aspects of the psyche were doing. And so that's what I felt like I was beginning to discover in lucid dreams, that behind the dream figures, behind the dreaming, was something that was aware and conscious and actually more broadly minded than any of the dream figures. And so that's when I began to think that lucid dreaming really was a gateway to the inner self.
Mm-hmm. So how has this practice helped you or benefited you in your own life or in terms of your personality development?
You know, one thing that's really helped me, by understanding the principles of how the lucid dream environment is created, it's really helped me understand how I can better create my waking life, how I can better use my beliefs and better use my expectation and intent and focus to really achieve what I want to achieve in the waking life. And so that's one thing. Also, the other thing, dreams are a great platform to see how to deal with emotions and feelings. As often occurred to me in a lucid dream, if I was being chased by something that was harassing me or upsetting me, I realized the thing wasn't to attack the hostile object, that instead, if I would project love and compassion onto it, normally it would suddenly transfigure into something that was friendly and not hostile at all. And so it also made me realize that in those situations in life, when we have kind of a knee-jerk reaction to get upset with and fight back, that really if we can have a higher step of awareness and begin to try to seek love and compassion towards that person or object or situation, it'll really make things go so much better.
Mm-hmm. What about lucid dreaming and self-healing? I've been having some hip pain, and my fantasy is that if I could become lucid, I could go into the hip area and do some inner healing or invite a dream physician or a dream shaman to heal that area, and that it might actually have some impact in waking reality. Is there any evidence for that sort of thing?
You know, there's quite a body of evidence, and a lot of it's been brought together by Ed Kellogg. Ed Kellogg got a PhD in biochemistry from Duke, and has really researched this area and conducted a lot of lucid dream healing upon himself and in some experiments on others as well. But it does seem like there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that people who become consciously aware in the dream state and decide to focus healing energy on some part of their body that's not functioning well or diseased, oftentimes have very rapid recovery. I remember recently in the Lucid Dream Exchange, which is a quarterly publication that I co-edit, a young woman was having trouble with anxiety, but she was also a very good lucid dreamer. So I suggested to her the next time she became consciously aware in the dream state to announce to the dream that she was not going to have any anxiety for the upcoming week. And she started doing this, and she's been amazed at how her life has changed. Now she doesn't have near the anxiety that she used to just because she announces or affirms in the dream that she'll no longer have that kind of sense. So physical healing and also kind of emotional and psychological healing is something that lucid dreamers are practicing with considerable success.
So that really helps to answer the question of why do it. That's a good motivation right there.
It really does. For a lot of people, it's a powerful motivation.
Yeah. Now, what about lucidity and things like dream telepathy? And do you even have a chapter on mutual lucid dreaming? So maybe talk about those two elements.
Yeah. As a person goes deeper into lucid dreaming and begins to have interesting experiences with dream figures and all, there's a natural tendency to just keep going and see how deep is the pond, how wide is this lake of information and knowledge. And so myself and others, we've sought precognitive information, we've sought telepathic information, and sometimes we've even sought to meet other lucid dreamers experimentally while consciously aware in the dream state. And to really understand it, you'd have to read my book, but the basic point I'd like to make is it appears that these things are possible. It appears that in some cases a person is able to get telepathic information. For example, I had a college student write me who asked me, whether or not I thought someone could do this. And I said, sure, I think you can do it. But I told him that I couldn't prove it to him, but he could prove it to himself. And just by conducting an experiment in a lucid dream. So he and a friend in his dormitory decided that the next time he became consciously aware, he would go to her dorm room and find the odd freckle on her back and be able to tell her where this odd freckle on her back is. And so the first time he tried it, he had all these difficulties. He became lucid, and he just couldn't get to her room and saw this kid start yelling at him, that this was crazy and all this kind of stuff. The next time he became consciously aware, he decided that he would have her come to his room and make it easier on himself. So this young woman came into his dorm room while he's consciously aware and pulled up her shirt so that he could see the spot where her weird freckle was. And so he woke up from that, ran down to her dorm room, knocked on the door, and told her he had had this lucid dream, and now he knew where her freckle was. And the odd thing was, it wasn't where he expected. He felt like she had hinted that it was on the side of her back, but instead, it was at a very unusual place on her lower back, and he put his finger right on top of it, and she pulled up her shirt, and there it was. So when people can do this for themselves, I know it kind of upsets our notions of linear time and that sort of thing and linear space, but I think lucid dreaming is one of these tools that will help us broaden those notions and maybe get to see what some of these physicists have been telling us all along.
Okay, well, before we close off, you're about to be president of the International Association for the Study of Dreams. Maybe you can tell our listeners a bit about the organization.
The International Association for the Study of Dreams is an organization that's been in existence for 25 years now. It has about 600 members. Some of them are therapists and psychologists who use dreaming in their practice. Some of them are academics and neuroscientists who investigate dreaming either from a neurological perspective or a cognitive psychology perspective. And then there's people who are dreamers like myself and lucid dreamers who are just curious about dreaming and have a very deep interest in it. They have an annual conference each year, and it's an incredible, incredible event because you get to hear so many views on dreaming and research on dreaming and also people's experiments and experiences on dreaming. It's very much a worthwhile organization to get involved in if you have an interest in dreaming. And you can find them on the internet at asdreams.org.
Yes, and I would certainly underscore that I've both been a presenter and an attendee at a number of them, and really want to underscore that you don't have to be a scientist or a therapist to join. Just anybody can join as long as they have the interest. Do you have any particular goals you hope to accomplish during your presidency?
You know, my main goal is just to expand the organization. We have such a great group, and I don't think it's as well known as it could be. Mm-hmm. And so to expand the awareness of the organization and also maintain the research and academic interest in the subject of dreaming and all is really my goal.
Well, I'm doing my part to help you in getting the word out. As we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to leave our audience with?
The only thing that I'd like to say is that in lucid dreaming, I think we have a revolutionary tool that we can begin to probe deeper in to the nature of identity, the nature of the self, and also come to understand the unconscious in dreaming from the inside instead of the outside. And for that reason, I really think lucid dreaming is going to provide us a lot more insights and experimental evidence for what dreaming is really all about in the future.
Well, Robert Wagoner, thanks so much for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
David, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks very much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Robert Wagoner. Personally, I was fascinated by the fact that a young boy growing up in rural Kansas comes across a book in his high school years that ends up opening whole realms of consciousness, including those written about by the Tibetan Buddhists 1,000 or more years ago, and then to have actually recorded 1,000 of his own lucid dreams certainly puts him in the ranks of the top athletes of lucid dreaming. In our brief conversation after the recorder was turned off, Robert let me know that he's eager to spread the word about his new book. It's put out by a small publisher, and of course publishers do very little in the way of PR for most authors these days. I'm pleased to be able to personally recommend this book to you if the topic of lucid dreaming is one you wish to explore further. And Robert let me know that he's eager to give other interviews. So if you're a podcaster and you'd like to interview him, he'll be happy to hear from you. Or if you listen to other podcasts where you think an interview would be appropriate, I'd be happy to pass along his contact information. He also mentioned to me after our interview that the next IASD conference will take place in Chicago, June 26th through June 30th of 2009. You can find more information on that conference by going to their website at www.asdreams.org. Depending upon what else is going on in my life, I may go and do more interviews on the spot as I did a couple of years ago, when the conference was conveniently held in my backyard, practically, at Sonoma State University. At some point, I hope to revisit this topic by interviewing Dr. Alan Wallace, who is steeped in Tibetan Buddhism and comes at lucid dreaming from that angle. I heard him interviewed on the Buddhist Geeks podcast and also was fortunate enough to hear him speak and to meet him at the Happiness Conference that I reported on in a recent podcast. So let's all get lucid.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Davis here to remind you it's all in your mind. Exploring our spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Shrink Wrap Radio, you will find you. We're all in your mind. We're all in your mind. We're all in your mind.
It's been a long time since I played the long version of that song with all its verses. I just felt the impulse to do so, and I hope you enjoyed it. Seemed to me it matched the tone of the interview. Happy New Year, everybody. Today happens to be January 2nd, 2009. My adult daughter, Kira, was a New Year's baby. The family all got together to celebrate her birthday last night at a very nice Japanese restaurant in nearby Petaluma, California. Happy birthday, Kira! I have a new interview up on my other podcast at wisecounselpodcast.com. It's with Victoria Limley Beckner, PhD, on treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder. So if you're interested in that topic, you'll want to catch it. Hey, this is show number 189, which means number 200 will be here before we know it. It would be nice to be able to do something special for that landmark. I'd love it if you would record some brief congratulatory messages that I could play on the show. You can either send me an MP3 file, use the MyChingo application on our site, or leave a voicemail on Skype or on our phone at 206-337-0622. Next week is Mac World, and I'm looking forward to my annual trek down to San Francisco with several of my Mac buddies. As you may know, I'm a big Apple Mac fan. I prepare these shows on an iMac, which is probably my 15th Mac over the years, and I also have both an iPod and an iPhone. I'm not very materialistic these days, but when it comes to these techno toys, well, I just might have to make an exception. I was disappointed to learn that Steve Jobs won't be there this year and that Apple won't be there at all next year. Ah, the times, they are a-changin'. Let me remind you again that I have a short promo video under the Promos tab at Shrink Wrap Radio, and I would like to encourage you to grab it and put it on your blog, MySpace, or Facebook page to help get the word out. I continue to feel that this content deserves a much wider audience. There are also flyers under that promos tab that you can print out and post on any appropriate places where people put up flyers. The Shrink Wrap Radio logo continues to be featured on the higher education page of iTunes for months and months, and currently we're ranked at number 15 among higher education podcasts. As you continue to let your friends and colleagues know about Shrink Wrap Radio in the coming year, I'm hoping we'll climb in the charts. Remember, Shrink Wrap Radio is supported by your donations. Show us some New Year's love by clicking on the big green donate button at shrinkwrapradio.com. And while your cash donations are greatly appreciated, I'm also grateful for all the other forms of support you offer, including your emails, the comments you post, the voice messages you leave, the volunteer transcriptions, the way you help to spread the word, and of course, the fact that you listen at all. I should also mention those of you who've advertised on our Top Spots widget, as well as those who've taken advantage of the discounts on our website from GoDaddy, Budget, Brookstone, and PetMeds.com. Those discount codes are still there, and they do help to support the show. For all of these contributions, I'm very grateful indeed. And also, I'm personally really stoked by Animoto.com. Their service lets you quickly and easily create an MTV-style video from still photos that you upload. If you sign up for a year for $30 using my affiliate link on our site, they will make a very nice donation to Shrink Wrap Radio. You can see my very first Animoto creation under the promos menu at Shrink Wrap Radio. It's a short montage of family photos from our 2008 Christmas. Check it out. Also, let me remind you that this show is part of the Science Podcasters Network at sciencepodcasters.org and the Medical Podcasters Network at podmed.com.
Hi, this is Kira Van Nuys-Martin, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave. And
thank you, birthday girl. Notice that I'm not saying how many. Now let's catch up on a little email. Thanks to Michael in Illinois, who sent along a link to a New York Times Science article titled A Highly Evolved Propensity for Deceit, which shows that even apes engage in certain forms of deceit, not just certain politicians and Wall Street types. Michael also wrote to say, quotes, "Actually, I was thinking about one or two shows about the various intelligences of animals as reflected in the article. Experts on animal intelligence would make interesting guests." Well, that's a good suggestion, Michael, and I will try to keep it in mind. Next, Cody in Israel writes, "Hi, David. First, thank you so much for your wonderful podcasting. I continue to listen to them and enjoy all of them. I especially liked your last couple of podcasts on wise counsel on the topic of harm reduction. One was called An Interview with Pat Denning, PhD on Harm Reduction Psychotherapy for Substance Abuse and Addiction, and the other was an interview with Annie Fahey, MSW, on motivational interviewing." She writes, "I agree with you. It's very important that these people get some kind of treatment that can help them to cope better with their addiction." She also writes later that she likes the fact that they are not blamed in the harm reduction approach. In her email, Cody also noted that she was not able to use our discount code to renew her GoDaddy domain names. I had not previously been aware of that, but I'm afraid there's nothing that I can do about it. The GoDaddy discounts that we offer are for first-time purchases only. And finally, we hear from Joe Down Under, who writes, "Hi, David. Thanks again for another interesting episode." And she's referring to number 188, Technology and the Evolving Brain, with Gary Small, MD. She writes, "I mainly wanted to give you feedback on your remarks at the end of the show where you ponder the need to cut down the number of episodes you can produce once your time is more constrained by your return to teaching. I do enjoy all the work you produce, and as you know, I listen to every episode, some more than once. I think the main thing is that you continue to enjoy making the sessions, otherwise it will not be sustainable for you. And at the worst, you may lose interest in podcasting altogether. So I prefer that you pace yourself depending on the other demands on your time and other interests you have. And if that means one podcast per week, per month, or per day, that is all just great as far as I'm concerned, as long as you still feel keen to keep going. Cheers from Joe." Joe, thanks for those words of support. We'll just have to see how it works out. I must say, I'm very compulsive. Somehow I'm locked into this once a week thing. I may have to slow down. But so far, my compulsive nature has me continuing to churn them out. Okay, I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember, send your emails to me, shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows on the comments area. You can leave voicemails on Skype for ShrinkPod. You can use the MyChingo link to record a message, and our message phone is 206-337-0622. Thanks to Robert Wagoner for his insights on lucid dreaming. Next week's return guest is Dr. Sharon Livingston, who will be discussing Iconocards, a new tarot deck that she's created. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.